Hello, this is Daedalus, and you're listening to Groovement with Agent J.
Okay, I'm in Johnny Dubb's bedroom with Daedalus. Daedalus, it's a pleasure. Hello.
Yeah, thank you very much.
How long have you been in the UK? I know you played Sheffield on Tuesday, which is my hometown, but how long have you been over here?
I've been over for about a day before that, so I'm going to be a total of 6 days. I think I'm in the middle, right around the middle of all that.
Okay, so is it a six-day mini-tour? Are you on to Europe, or are you back to the States after?
No, I've bounced from Europe here, and I'll be back to Europe right after this, and then go back to the States, tour the States, then come back to Europe for a small spell, and I think I'm on continuous touring this year thus far. It's been an interesting run.
So you've got it's a festival, a little festival called Future Sonic, which runs tomorrow, and it's all about, well, from the name, Future Sonics. Where do you think in May 2009 electronic music is at?
Well, first and foremost, I'm really happy to be here and included in this collection of really extraordinary artists here in Manchester. It's not lightly that I take the chance to be in front of a really in a different venue like Urbis, which is a kind of a modern art museum, and in a city like Manchester, which has a storied history of music and stuff. So it's really quite an amazing chance. In terms of where music at is in 2009, it's kind of hard to say because, you know, in the UK, it really does exist in these kind of micro genres. There's a lot of fragmentation of genre, but still, people seem to hold pretty fast on some categories and stuff. And coming from Los Angeles, there's a freedom that exists there right now in the city where there's a lot of anything is possible. There's a lot of, you know, people are upping each other in these kind of genreless ways. And even though we're still subject to the same kind of categorizations, I mean, people look at us and think we're doing beat music. There's plenty of dubstep-ish kind of kids. There's plenty of indie rock kids or noise or whatever. But the fact that people seem to be relatively borderless, that at events you'll have all kinds of different collections of indie rock and rap and hip-hop and beats and stuff, and it's all in the same grab bag. That's the gift that we have in 2009, at least in stateside. I'm not sure if it's everywhere, but it certainly is strongly embedded in our mindset right now. So
does most of that in LA tend to be centered around low-end theory, or is there a plethora of similar sort of...
Low-end theory is just one aspect. Low-end theory happens to be a very successful club, and it really does a great presentation of these sounds. It has a great sound system, very dedicated audience that are amazing, amazing fans. But it is just a Wednesday, you know? I mean, if you want to go out any other given night, it's going to be a different thing. And low-end does a fantastic job, like I said, but there's a lot of other collectives and spaces that are doing great work. There's the Crosby, which is more a little bit further east in L.A., and they're holding down, it's Free the Robots Club, they're holding down a great assortment of beat makers and musicians. Then there's Dub Lab, which is more of an internet radio station, but they have events, and they have podcasts, and they have a great downloadable content that is a whole other avenue and aspect of sound. And then there's thousands of other holes in the wall that have their own clientele, their own scene, their own... I mean, it's 10 million people in the city, you know. To think that low end is the end all be all is kidding yourself. It's almost like a fool's pride kind of thing. It's one aspect of a huge city. And we're very lucky that we can be on these shores and have some championing from local radio as well as international radio, but just luck and just a great artist community. Just very simple.
Do you find that there's a lot of young kids that come to the nights that are being influenced to make music sort of there and then and come and hungry for it and come and bring people like you beats? And
it's crazy. Every time I go out on the street anywhere, people will come up with demo CDs, MP3s. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of kids that make up that scene are aspiring beat makers, and why not? They all should be, you know, and they all have valid voices. It's unfortunate that there's limited time and that there's only so many that'll be heard, and through a variety of politics and luck and chance, some kids will be selected and others won't. Very talented kids don't always get the fair shake, but it's cool. We live in a scene right now where a lot of it can be heard, even if it's only kids shouting at the top of their lungs. And LA has a wonderful competitive / supportive scene where people are constantly driving each other to do better, but also very supportive of each other's noise makings. So, you know, it's that combination that allows us to be relatively genre free at this time. And trust me, I'm a little too... I'm a little too in the game to be associated with this current crop of beatmakers or the juniors that are even under them that are coming up. And I'm also not senior enough to really get the benefit of being a veteran of the scene necessarily. There's plenty of people who've earned their stripes much more than me, so it's really the kind of thing where I'm just happy to be along for this crazy ride and do my small thing in its own way, and to witness the music that's going on, because it's astounding and it's powerful, and I'm constantly inspired by my peers.
How long has it felt? I mean, it feels like what you're talking about is quite a special time, you know, what's happening. How long has it felt that good?
Well, to be honest, it's really, LA really began to transform itself away from being an MC-centric or more commercial-centric scene in the late 90s. There was definitely a feeling where there was a crop of musicians centered around the Good Life of Freestyle Fellowship, as well as some indie rock acts that really came up in the mid-90s. And really found a voice for themselves, and some of them went pop, basically. You know, they crossed over in ways like the Far Side and groups that, you know, I think are associated on a more international level, or, you know, or even people that never really made it. But there was basically this big push that people started to get signed, and so you see this whole generation of kids that were signed and let go. And it really left some kids disillusioned, and also some kids just to put their strength and energy back into LA and kind of give up on this whole idea of really breaking out and doing this crazy, you know, major label thing.
And I suppose that goes hand in hand with the internet age, doesn't it? Because suddenly you don't need a major label, because you've got what we were just chatting about in the other room. We were chatting about blogs and blah. If you've got MySpace and you've got Rupert Murdoch, you know, but that's the other aspect of it. If you've got MySpace, then you've got a voice.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely felt the benefit of that. I was featured on the MySpace in the US, and it changed things a little bit. But in a funny way, you know, it's an aspect now. That's the real thing that's changed. It isn't like the old way was selling CDs and doing shows, and now the new way is blogs and something else. The new way is everything. The old way, everything you did was to sell a CD. Now everything you do is everything you do, and it's all a part of this pie. It's
not necessarily one release that you're building up to anymore, is it?
I think, if anything, releases are now really difficult. You know, we live in an age where people pick things apart generally. They've already taken it apart in their mind. It's so pick and choose. It's such a a la carte kind of idea. And it's a shame, because there's a lot of classic records that won't get their shake right now, because people just aren't imbibing their culture that way right now. So, you know, it's just a different way of looking. And so now the experience is a holistic one. Now people are looking to people for storytelling rather than music making, and it's the same definition. It means the same things. It says the same things. It's just semantically a different idea. It changes it.
Do you think people are looking for stories in music? A lot of instrumental music can still tell a story, you know, emotionally. It's obviously your gigs, each one, I think, is unique in the story it is. Do you think people have a need for that in 2009?
Oh, more than ever, by far. There isn't. It isn't like the internet's telling a cohesive story right now. So culturally, I feel people are very hungry for real emotional gravity. And maybe I'm just very biased in saying this because I'm a sucker for romantic swooningness and stuff. But if it isn't telling me a compelling tale, I'm not listening. And I'm so amazed and happy that so many people are telling those stories and are involving me in their story. You know, it's not about telling a story and just monologuing. It's about dialogue. People's live sets, people's records, it all has to be about the dialogue. Why else even take the time? I mean, I have 50 hours of music that I haven't even heard on my iPod, you know? And it's partially because people are gracing me with their new releases of music and demos, but also it's partially because there's just a limited time in the day. And so if it isn't compelling, I'm not there. Gigs, everything.
We're talking about the conversation there, and I know you posted a little thing on MySpace about having a couple, you know, looking forward to the tour, and you're unable to have a conversation there. Do you find it frustrating in a way when you've put an LP out, for instance, because that is then done with? You can't change that without releasing a remix album. You know, you've had to come to a point where you go, right, that is that tune is finished, those 12, 14, 16 songs are finished. Because obviously when you're doing a gig, you can improve on that and you can change it. Do you find it a frustration having to put an LP out, or is it a joy?
It's still a joy. I feel like if I didn't have a perspective, it would be a burden. LPs aren't fixed things. As much as I hear what you're saying, I mean, they are assigned to these kind of immovable CDs or digital formats, and they don't change. But the reality is that when people are listening, they assign emotional content. They have their own stories to tell. They break up with someone. They fall in love. They lose people. They find them. It's they are very moving, and people have these experiences that totally radically change the content. And also, it's the fantastic thing that people misinterpret stuff. You know, you do a song, it's called Fairweather Friends, and it has this kind of nice negative overtone. I mean, I'm just saying, metaphorically speaking, specifically speaking about my own experience, Fairweather Friends is trying to find the best possible meaning out of a song. That Fairweather Friends is somebody who is only there when you need them, or when they need you, and they're not there when you need them. That's what a Fairweather Friend means. It's a slang term, or whatever, an oldie slang term. And I was trying to find the best possible spin of that, but it still has that slightly funny negative overtone. And it's, you know, it's supposed to be a wry kind of humor. People just think it's just like the most happy-go-lucky song. You know, it's like the whole idea of that kind of thing is to, you know, you twist ideas, you try to throw them around, and people don't get it. They get their own thing, and that's fantastic. That's the way it should be. Of course, in the live situation, you're right. I mean, we can hone it down to be even more specific and stuff. But it's just all different. It's just all different scattershots. It's all different meanings. That if you don't embrace all the different formats, I think you're cheating yourself as a musician. You know, why? Right now, I'm unable to release as much as I would like to, and it's because we're still not totally able to live our fully moving lives. I mean, there's still some restrictions on supply and demand. I don't think I'm in demand enough that people want to hear my whole supply, basically. But someday I hope to really be able to release at the level and the degree that I would like to, and then it's the kind of thing where I think culture is ready. I think people are ready generally for more perspectives. I think people are hungry for more perspectives. They're hungry for some more strong attitudes. Not necessarily saying words, but musically. There's a lot of room. There's too many love songs. There's too many out of love songs. There's not enough, you know, not enough jealousy songs. There's not enough, you know, losing your father songs. There's not enough, you know, there's so many other emotional places that we can go, and just people aren't saying. It's more time for that.
Do you feel like you've got more of a chance to do that, or people generally will understand that more with The Long Lost because it's more lyrical and there's more, shall we say, traditional instruments? Do you feel it's more accessible?
It's to some people. I mean, a lot of people are trained to hear the lyrics first and then hear music. You know, it's just an inevitability of our current age. Not everyone's a muso who loves reference samples, you know. That's just another thing, you know, and maybe it's more populist, maybe not. I don't know how many people are even going to come across The Long Lost. It's okay. The thing with The Long Lost, for instance, it's made to be a whisper, you know, it's made to be a secret that a loved one gives to you or something. It's kind of designed like that, and if it takes 20 years for 20 people to hear it, I'm not angry at that. I mean, that's took us 10 years to make it, and so...
Well, I was going to say, you've got on the MySpace, I'm guessing when you were, because we're similar sort of ages, when you were about 17 and then maybe about 21... you came back to it. Is that right? Give us a brief sort of history of it.
Well, I mean, my now wife and I dated in high school, and it was a tumultuous affair, and it was one of the heart. We kept in touch even after it ended. I mean, I'm glad it ended, because if it had continued, it basically would have fallen apart when we'd both gone to college separately. Just the inevitable things, you know, just going through life and sowing wild oats and all that kind of stuff. And we met a few years later, basically, and it was fantastic. Everything one dreams of when you re-meet the love of your life and have everything.
In my head, it's a song. Sorry to interrupt there, but in my head, you've met again and you're singing to each other. And does it seem like that?
That's what happens, basically. That's what happened. You know, we both are musicians, and how else do you express yourself when words are little failures? They're always imperfect. You know, music's perfect. That's the way I've lived my life, basically. And been very fortunate to have the ability to make a living at it, but I would be doing it anyways if I wasn't. It's an addiction. I think any musician can tell you, they, you know, it's great to make a living, but it's really the only way you really keep going at it, because it's not the easiest life, but because you're addicted to it, it keeps going. And to have someone else that's also equally needs this thing to happen, needs it to happen, needs that it can exist, and that's how we exist together generally. The record needed to come out of the world just because we had sung it to each other so many times that I think it had to find a way out. And it's not all love songs either. It's not all, you know, a lot of it actually is telling other kinds of stories, especially about love lost and about the other kinds of sets of emotions, more personal emotions. I'm really happy the fact that Laura's perspective is well represented on the record, and she produces half the record. It's not always easy being a solo artist in a room making tracks. It's not my dream. but it happens a lot as an electronic musician. You're in your room alone, struggling with big ideas and trying to find them into small places. You know, a few thousand hertz of frequency. You have to fit huge, everlasting emotions. I mean, it's tough. It's really tough, with or without words. You know, and The Long Lost is another set of frequencies, basically.
When Ryan and Johnny came back, we sat in the flat looking at some of the videos and saw a little gig that you'd done, a little bit of that. Do you have sort of venues and a tour in mind, or are you just going to do the occasional sort of LA? It looked like a little concert hall type.
It was actually, it's an amazing space that we had that performance in. That was our record release party that maybe you saw clips of. They were very, it was wonderful. They were in town. We stole them away from Manchester for a few days and they came to the gig. It was cool timing. We did it in a panorama. I don't know if you guys, your listeners are familiar, but a panorama is an old Victorian entertainment. You know, it's like these surround mural that conjures up an idea of a very far away place, even if you can't go there. And this panorama happens to feature an Arctic scene, so you kind of feel like the tundra and the desolation. It's amazing. And we had a concert there. It was quite a fun experience. But no, we hope to tour it more, and hopefully, we did do a tour a few months ago, and we got a chance to do some great shows, but hoping to do more unique settings, because that's where our story gets best told, we've discovered, is in settings where our quiet sound can resonate a bit, versus maybe my slightly super louder sound, as it likes to happen sometimes live as Daedalus. It's fun to be a little bit more riotous. It's fun to mine the unpredictable nature of audiences. I really do feel like with The Long Lost, we're whispering, and with my stuff, I'm not yelling, but I'm also, I'm kind of clogging, I guess, kind of stomping about. So it's just different aspects, and we're going to hopefully divide that up, but do some touring together still. So people during the day can have a tea party, and at night can have a rave up. It's why not? You know, we're not all doing all, as much as we can. And I feel sometimes the weight of the world for that, because I'm going to die soon. You know, give me a handful of years, even if it ends up being a long life. Just, it's still such a brief moment. If I don't get 100 records out, I'm going to be really disappointed when they mummify me and take my organs out. Excuse me.
At what age, we talk about panoramas, at what age did Victoriana start to sort of seep into your life?
Really in my mid-teens, I began to be aware that fashion and art and music didn't end or begin with the way you express yourself on a record. Or it really began to be this kind of thing where I began to be aware that art was something that was always, you know, and it's not just Andy Warhol. It's not these people that kind of made pop art. You know, it isn't this kind of thing that exists around us. It exists in us. We're all manifestations of these art forms, and I was really obsessed with these ideas and searching around for some meaning in it, and I came across the words of both some amazing poets and writers, but also Beau Brummel, who was kind of the proto-dandy, the prototypical dandy, and I began to embrace some of these ideals just as something to, like, kind of inform my own artistic musings. I mean, like, you know, you're you're an awkward teenager. I don't mean to talk in third person. I'm an awkward teenager, overweight and without love, only occasionally encountering the awkwardly in marching bands and living this music life and not knowing how to express myself at all. And you start hearing about these things where these people are both elegant and well-spoken and really make sense of the senseless. You know, I think there's lots of different ways that people do this, religion or whatever. I just happen to do it now through embracing and celebrating life as an art form. And not that I do it well, but it's the aspect that keeps the sanity. So Victoriana is something that informs that. There's a lot of amazing absurdities that's in Victoriana that I really enjoy. And also the idea of invention permeates the whole thing. The greatest inventions of the modern world, almost all of them came about in the Victorian age. And that's staggering. That's a life-changing little realization for me. So take all that, and I'm happy for a lifetime.
The age of industrialization. Do you?
It's pre the age.
Go on, correct me.
Sorry, the age of industrialization happened right after Edwardian age. That's the invention of the modern factory basically. Yeah. Happened. I mean, they had factories, but this is like the real machine, and the machine-made idea was right after. The Victorian age is this amazing moment. Everything's handmade, right? And yet everything is also getting faster. The telegraph, the phonograph, you know, photography, it's all happening like crazy. And everything now with the internet, it pales in comparison to the
mass production
came and bounds that happened right then. And still people were at the center of it. It's crazy, you know? Even if it was a child laborer's hands, they did amazing things with those hands. Nowadays, child labor hands do kind of blunt, stupid things, you know? They solder one element of something. You don't find artists in that. You do find artists, though, when you get a piece of mourning jewelry, of hair jewelry from the Victorian age. Like, that's something they can't do anymore. It's a lost art. How many things are lost arts nowadays? You know, maybe early computer programming. It's totally different. And just because I happen to embrace that using electronic music doesn't mean it's any less valid, I hope. It's quite a tangent, but yeah.
No, not at all. I mean, given that you've got your electronic side and your pre-industrial side,
I think there's a correlation between DIY music and handmade objects. I think that's part of why the beatmaker idea, the idea of a genius musician, is really analogous to an artisan, you know, making a knife or something. It's all the same kind of idea. You're just honing this thing down. You're sharpening it yourself. You're building it up. You're folding the metal. It's all the same idea. It's just, you know, how many things in our lives nowadays are one person making one thing? It's very few. You know, it isn't like we're making our instruments, but we're doing everything in that. And sometimes we are making our instruments, you know, circuit bend stuff, instrument creation. It's all happening nowadays. And there's nothing else that I can think of other than other arts, that you're making something from beginning to end, and it's out in the world because of your efforts. I mean, it's the gift we've been given to give to other people. It's crazy.
Looking at that new with old, do you sort of rate a lot of the steampunk stuff that in the last few years a lot of artists have, you know, here's if an iPod was around in Victorian times, or someone, oh, this is a steampunk PC. Does that sort of stuff ring true with you, or does it sort of get to a point where you think, no, it's not real Victorian stuff, it's fake?
You know, certainly there's a lot of people marveling at play. I mean, but I do like anytime you can change people's perception by altering their consciousness slightly, and that can be through any number of means. And trust me, every rave people have ever gone to is just trying to alter people just slightly, trying to get them to look at things differently. You know, you're in a dark room full of people wondering in wonder at the moving images in front of you in the theater. You're in a dark room full of people full of wonder to some music being played by an anonymous DJ or at a live act. I mean, these are all very analogous things. This is why they're never going away, is because our shared relationship and connection. And it's the same thing with these steampunk ideas. You're just trying to make you look at these benign objects slightly differently. And what if, you know, it's not an unvalid question, and that yearning for knowledge is as much of a valid response to the absurdity of a world around us, the meaninglessness of it. I mean, the biggest motivator for kids nowadays is boredom. It's not, oh, what amazing wonders can we make? How can I make a life out of this amazing? It's just, I'm tired, I'm bored, and there's nothing to do. So let me do something weird and crazy and exciting. I mean, and that's not invalid. I'm just saying, like, we're looking at the lowest common denominator if this is the case. And why not try to inspire something else? And so that's what I think a lot of steampunk is yearning for, a different way of looking. And also, elegance is not a lost art form. People are living it in many different ways. And some of steampunk is about finding real artisanship in everyday things. So it's cool. It's great. I'm not always the biggest fan, but, you know, just because I happen to focus on 1830s to 1850s doesn't mean that I'm any less of a steampunk, even though they tend to like pre-World War I era stuff. You know, it's a little minor twitches.
Well, I suppose a lot of steampunk is such a combination of ideas that a lot of people are going to assume that Mr. General Public, Joe Public, doesn't really have this specific knowledge, that they're going to take it as given anyway, aren't they?
Oh, but the magic of the internet means that everyone knows everything nowadays.
Wikipedia.
Everyone's a Wikipedia now. I mean, it's not just the fact you can look it up on the internet, but just the way we've hyperlinked information, the way it's all at our fingertips. It's like, to make any assumptions about anybody is to call them stupid and dumb. And nowadays, I think the beautiful thing is you can assume that your audience knows everything, or they soon will. And they've heard everything, or they soon will. And using that statement in mind, I mean, it just makes so you have to have original thought. You have to have original sounds. You have to, and even if that's using older things to create newness, it's like, it's the imperative. And that's fantastic, because if we didn't have this fire burning underneath us, we'd just get, again, back to those lazy and fat and dumb. I mean, there's no going back anymore, you know?
When you're on stage, do you get sounds in your head that you haven't got in front of you and you can't produce, and you feel frustrated with that? Or are you very aware of every single thing you've got in front of you and what you're going to create? Do you never think, oh, if only I could have a blip blip here and I just haven't got it?
Well, I do very much prize the fact that I'm using this kind of specialized equipment called a Monome, and some of the software, this MLR software that's been user-created, that allows for a huge amount of freedom. Now, it isn't total freedom, but the thing that's fantastic is that, okay, I want a blip blip. The sample set I'm using in front of me at this moment doesn't necessarily have a blip blip, but you know what, I bet you, if I manipulate the samples, if I play the right combinations, I can get it. And that's my whole goal when I'm playing live. I'm there as much with the audience, hopefully, as they're with me, and I'm trying to mine the unconscious. Now, that isn't to say that I don't have routines. I mean, I know certain samples go with other samples. I have shapes, because if I'm totally formless, it can be quite a wander. And I've done that, trust me, plenty of times with audiences, where I'll just dump an unknown amount of samples from my stuff, other people's stuff, and we just go wassail around and just look to see what happens. And it can be kind of rootless. I generally, if somebody's paid to get into a room, I really want them to have the best experience possible. So that's a little bit of, okay, I'm going to do this, some of my classic songs from back catalog of records, and they're really not classic. You know, maybe five or six people in a room have heard them, but I want to do that for those five or six people who have these expectations for a concert. So I'll do that for them. I'll play some maybe better known things, maybe some regional music that I think might impress somebody, just to make them happy. But then a lot of it is, well, okay, we're all feeling this blip, blip, blip thing. I don't have it in any of my samples, so we're going to manipulate, we're going to cross-reference, we're going to change and transform until we get some new moment. And that new moment is really what I prize. That moment of invention where on the spot, with just 10 fingers and the software and the audience, we make something together that's totally new and has that one moment of resonance, and then it's gone forever. You know, maybe someone records it, but it's different. When you're in a room full of 1,000 people and you share this moment and it has this resonance and everyone knows that they were there for that moment and then it's over, that's the magic of music, you know? There's one thing I really think that's most important about music over every other art form, and people can argue with me for days philosophically, but you can never turn off your ears. You can close your eyes, you don't have to breathe them through your nose, you don't have to taste the air, but you can never shut your ears. And that means you're hearing everything all the time. And so what makes an impact? You know, you'd imagine the ears would be the most tired orifice in your body. I mean, you'd be done. There's no reason that your ears would constantly be taking or interested in new sounds. You know, it's like, because it's just, they're overwhelmed. But it's really quite the opposite. They're constantly hungry. They're constantly trying to find something different and new and emotionally responsive. And when you get there, I mean, it's powerful as lightning. And I'm not saying it happens every show. It happens rarely. But when it does, it's undeniable. And that's, you know, that's the reason to go out in concerts, because you want something undeniable. So I'm very, very lucky, I feel like, because just every once in a while I get that to happen and I get to be part of it. it's nice.
Okay, let's change the ropes a little bit. Talk to me about martial arts.
Okay, yeah.
What martial arts does Daedalus practice when he's not in front of, not achieving that experience, an audience full of people?
I studied two martial arts. I did a little bit of Kung Fu Sansu, which is a family style from China. Kind of interesting, very, very peaceful and very aggressive at the same time. Philosophically, very interesting. Yeah, it's based around a certain idea that if you are willing to enter into the circle of violence, it kind of, there's a few different camps of martial arts, and this one kind of worships Kuan Yin, which is the goddess of mercy, and she is actually a very violent goddess in some ways. So if you're willing to enter the circle of violence, you have to finish the circle. So basically, if you're going to throw a punch, you have to be willing to kill the person, which is actually a very peaceful idea, because you should never throw a punch then, because why would you ever want to kill anyone? That being said, very interesting martial art, very, very, very big system, and a little difficult. The one I studied mostly, though, was this thing called, it's a southern martial art style, and, Wing Chun is kind of controversial, because there's a lot of different ways of saying it, a lot of different kinds of versions of it, but it's a very, very elegant, very beautiful kind of kung fu, and it's a southern, like I said, a southern Chinese style. Really beautiful movement, really beautiful ways of accessing other people and kind of instantaneous reactions and things. And I studied that for a deal of time and found a lot of success in the ideas of it, and some fun practicing it. I'm not the fastest on my feet, and I'm not definitely the most elegant. Thank goodness for music sometimes, because I really don't feel like I have anything else going for me. But it was very, very rewarding to study and practice it. And currently, the only martial art I do is on my monom, unfortunately, because I did have this unfortunate experience, and I might have mentioned this in some passing interview before, but I would go away on tour, and I would come back, and I'd be slightly decreased in my martial art skills. I just didn't practice as hard as I did when I was home, you know, with the wooden dummy and all these things. So basically, I would be practiced, and I would, you know, be doing my thing when I was at home, and I would go in, I'd come back and get punched in the face a bunch. And I would get my skills back and, you know, stop being punched in the face and, you know, kind of do my thing, and then I would leave on tour again and come back, and sure enough, bang, 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 you know.
Have you seen Kung Fu Panda?
Yeah, I have.
I'm thinking that.
Yeah, it's some sad truth. I mean, it's, man, studying martial arts, studying movement was one of the most rewarding things I ever did for my music. I mean, I study music for years and years and years, and I have this thorough understanding of, I mean, not thorough understanding, I have a very tenuous understanding of music theory and relationships, of chordal relationships and these kind of things, but I really learned more about electronics when I started learning how to hit people, you know? I started learning more about live performance when I really started to basically work with other people's energy and sometimes to punish them, and sometimes to reward them for my lackadaisicalness. And so I really believe when I'm touring, I actually am studying a martial art in a way.
This is what I was coming to, because if you know, your life balance, you know, you come back and find that you suck a little bit more at your martial art, but you've worked so hard on tour at taking that energy and reciprocating that energy, surely then your karma's balancing out anyway.
I don't know about karma exactly. I mean, being punched in the face is being punched in the face. There's not much karma to it. It's a very, very, it's a zero-sum equation, you know what I mean? You're getting punched in the face, and maybe there is some metaphor to it, but no, I do feel like performing and staying in a performance mode is a skill unto itself, and there's ways to perfect that by being emotionally aware. It's just an emotional martial art, and not to say that I'm terribly good at live performance. I don't, you know, I've been lucky, and I've had good nights, and I feel like it's something that I want to achieve the best aim I can and do my best for. And so that includes leading a slightly purer life than maybe I would if I didn't perform often. You know, I don't drink very, very often. I try to stay connected with people through a variety of means, and that includes people I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, try to do things in the world that make you more open, because I feel like it affects performance. You know, and that's why I'm here right now. Either performance in the studio or performance live, it's all the same game, you know. In the studio, you're just improvising. When it's right, it's effortless and it's improvised. Live, when it's right, it's effortless and improvised. And then when it's not a good night, it's not good in the studio, it's full of effort and it's laborious and it feels like work. And why would you ever want to do that? And why would you ever want to be punched in the face? So I try to do my best to defend myself against both.
How much was UK music sort of an influence in your music taste? Was there a UK aspect to it?
Yeah, it's pretty huge, actually. The first artist that really inspired me to do electronics was a fellow named Asen. When I was younger, I accidentally encountered rave music. And I listened to a whole bunch of music prior. I mean, I'd been playing music for years, and I'd played classical and jazz and some other things. But rave music really resonated with me because it was everything I'd ever delved for. It was enticing rhythm. It was moving melodies. It was everything, you know. And when I heard it, it left me awestruck. And yet, I didn't have any culture to assign it to. It isn't like there was rave culture, but I was far too young to really know about it. And so I just, you know, it was stuff for my living room. It was stuff for my headphones. I didn't know that people went so nuts about it as they did out here. And so in a lot of ways, it didn't really exist as rave culture for me, just as music. And I kept on going with it for years and years and tried to convince my friends of this wonderful stuff, and they mostly laughed at me. And who's laughing now? My mad villain moment I can try to work on. Yeah, wow. Who gets the last laugh? And it's not me for sure, but somebody hopefully wow. doing it. Basically, this rave stuff really, really set me on fire, and I've just been pursuing making my own version of that, basically. Just, you know, why have boundaries, why have labels? And I know we assigned this term rave to it, but really, it was a whole collection of genres that fragmented off into all the subgenres that we still work in. They did it all then. You know, sub-bass, low-slung beats, high-fast, I mean, amen breaks, I mean... trance, house, it all went through the filter this one period of time, 92 to 94, is beautiful pinpoint moment of music, and everyone played the same tempo, and we're totally there again, you know. Dubstep mixes into new rave, mixes into disco, mixes into electro, it's all the same, and I'm loving it. I'm loving all of it, and that's, you know, it was a British phenomenon. I know other places and people had an effect and had their own voice in this music, but it just happens to be for me that rave was the gateway drug that got me to have much wider ears and to really check out what they were sampling. And when I started checking out what the influence on those people were. And somewhere along the line, I got back to the music I'd been studying originally, bebop and classical music. If you go back far enough in film music, it's all classical music. If you go back far enough in ska, it's jazz. If you go back far enough in jazz, it's classical music. It's, we're not formless. It's crazy infinite, but it also is very finite, you know. You look at classical composers and they were sampling rural music. You know, they were sampling peasant music, and it's no accident. You know. We just happen to get sued for it nowadays. They didn't happen to. It sucks.
Looking at sort of trance, I've heard you mention trance a couple of times in interviews, and I don't know, there's a club called Gatecrasher in the sort of late 90s from Sheffield where I'm from, and that sort of music is a lot of, I picked up hip-hop and I picked up a lot of that sort of stuff at the time because it was all learning to mix, it was the same tempo and stuff, and there's massive sort of synth breakdowns, and every song seemed to follow this pattern of, you know, you start with your cymbal, you build up, then you've got your big emotional breakdown, because we had these arguments and arguments about, there is emotion in it. Does it, and now it all seems a little bit cheesy, does it sort of, is that something that you just don't like at all, that sort of genre? Or can you see that emotional resonance?
No, I actually can see it now. And for a long time, I didn't. For a long time, I couldn't quite get my headspace into it. And I think part of it was when I started playing bigger clubs and started seeing wider emotions. You know, it's almost like when you see theater acting versus Hollywood acting, you know, versus movie acting. There's Hollywood movies, they have these close-ups on faces where the slightest eyebrow raise tells a whole story. It's the depth of an emotion, you know, it's infinity. Theater acting, it's, you know, you kind of pantomime, you act with your whole body, you know, you have these broader emotions, and trance is that. Trance is these broader emotions where it's big room music, and it's cheesy as all get up, but it's for these broader emotions. And I don't think it tells the stories that I'm compelled to tell exactly, but I'm starting to understand and respect it, and choosing very deliberately not to necessarily dive into it too much, even though I can see that there's some room in there for, you know, there's, I think every genre has a compelling reason why somebody else wants to make it and follow in the footsteps of a genre. It's because there's classic tracks that people have responses to and they want to be part of this. They want to somehow give forth the emotion that they felt when they first heard that thing. And I just don't have that compulsion, but I do see it. And, you experiment in sounds, especially you experiment in cliches. And trance has so many cliches. It's so easy to pervert them and make them messy. And messy is so good. Messy is really good.
Okay, I'm going to bring this to a close and let us begin our evening. But what's your favourite current sound? You must hear so many sounds every day, and sort of catalogue them away. What's your favourite current sound?
So I have a few ridiculous things and a few sane things that I'm really into, that I've been turned on to by happenstance and demos and all these kind of things, just how it works. On the absurd side of things, I'm really into Italian beat music from the 60s right now. A large collection came my way of authentic, crazy, beat music. This kind of James Brown sounding, Beatles sounding, Italian messy music.
Are we talking like lots of Hammonds and...
Hammond, like organ breaks and stuff, and it's all 60s, late 60s, early 70s. Fantastic. I have hours and hours of it, and it's just blowing my mind, track after track. Just the way they twist and turn in these, in a really established idea. When you hear someone covering a Beatles song, you just expect certain things, and they don't have the same expectations, so it's great. And then another ridiculous one is UK bassline. Bassline house, Twitch house, Donk, or whatever that stuff is called. Donk's also low, I guess, but it's just the fact you take a kid who has every passion towards music, has no idea the equipment to use to make whatever sound they want to make, so they take whatever tools are at hand, and they make the music that excites them. And it ends up being a genre because other people like it and respond to it, but they're not making it out of some I'm going to make money. They're making it because they're just hungry. And that's fantastic. Every great genre comes out of hunger and need, And it's such a guilty, sickly sweet pleasure. But when somebody happens into a way that some bass line drops and fumbles around, oh, it's fantastic. I mean, all these guilty pleasures I'm dropping into my sets, because I'm curious to see how my unconscious mind or the audience's unconscious mind will wrap their heads around it. And then on the more serious side of things, I'm constantly hungry for new modern sounds, and I've been listening to a lot of softer music as well. And some louder music. I've been listening a little bit to Zoo. I've been listening a little bit to this guy Spen King, who was in the Dirty Projectors but found a way out of that a long time ago. I've been listening to Hovercraft and Godspeed You Black Emperor and really moody stuff that I have no connection with but feel compelled to, because they're saying some pretty crazy things, some pretty extreme things. And then, man, LA is so full of people making amazing music right now. I could just spend days and days listening to young beat makers from there and just be fine on the electronic side of things. So many people pushing their own boundaries and trying to find boundaries, and it's fantastic. It goes on and on and on and on and on. It's crazy. Yeah.
So we've got you tomorrow night at the Future Sonic with Martin's playing tonight, actually. Martin and Andra. Do you know who else you're playing with tomorrow night?
I'm playing with Toddler T, playing with Hudson Mohawk. It was originally supposed to be Tim Exile, but I think he had to cancel. I'm not sure. People should never cancel gigs. Never. Never.
You're looking forward. Actually, Stephanie McKay, singer from Brooklyn, just came over here. Her baby was born 6 weeks ago. But she'd already committed to the gig, so she was here.
See, that's what I'm talking about. I think some people encounter music as a gift that they're giving other people, and some people encounter it as a job. And I think the mixture of both. It's like, sure, it's a gift we're sharing between each other, but the show must go on. And this is, hey, I'm serious, I'm going to be around for a minute, and I'm going to do everything I can to sustain that. And if I miss a gig, it's because I absolutely can't be there. Somebody died, my plane went down, that kind of stuff. And I want people to understand that, I'm serious about music, and I know a lot of kids who aren't necessarily as serious, and you have to wonder about their commitment and what they're in this for. You know, I'm here to be responsible about this. Ownership issues, you know. Excuse me. Wow, that's a little tangent. That's
okay, cool. Have a good one. Thank you for chatting to Groove Vince. I think we need to finish now. No, have a top one tomorrow, and nice to have you in Manchester again, and come again very soon.
I hope so too. I hope we can do this all over again. That'd be fantastic.
Lovely. Take care.
Thank you very much. Hello, you're listening to Agent J on Groovement. Actually, let me give my name. Actually, yeah.
Otherwise, it sounds like me.
That's fantastic. Hello, this is Daedalus, and you're listening to Groovement with Agent J.